So we're going to try something a little new on Channel 9. You know that on Channel 9 we spend a lot of time talking about complex things, from programming languages to operating systems to you name it. But we want to really focus on this series. We want to investigate complexity itself. Like, what is it that makes things so hard? So who better to start this off than Dr. Brian Beckman, who is an astrophysicist as well as a computer scientist. And you all love him. He's been on Channel 9 many times. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Charles. Thanks for having me. Love seeing you again.
Right on.
Always love my Channel 9 my Channel 9 fix.
Your Channel 9 fix.
Yes.
So let's talk about complexity.
Well, there are all kinds of complexity. You know, in the physics world, of course, there are the world of physics is usually thought to be complex. And what physicists do is try to take complex things and turn them into simpler things. It's building blocks. Again, the same kind of thing that happens in when you're controlling complexity in a computer program. You try to reduce something that's apparently complex to things that are simpler. Mm-hmm. And so that's one kind of complexity. For example, quantum field theory. There's a really, you know, sort of complex,
yes.
Complex area. What's really going on there? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a marriage of quantum mechanics and field theory. Each one of those two pieces can be independently understood. You can understand quantum mechanics from the point of view of particles, and you can understand field theory from a point of view of something like electromagnetics or even gravitation. Mm-hmm. You try to put them together and come up with something that's maybe a little less complex. Mm-hmm. I tend to think of complexity as falling into the following two categories. There's accidental complexity and there's essential complexity. The essential complexity is inherent in the particular problem that you are addressing, and you're not going to be able to reduce it. Mm-hmm. The accidental complexity is brought to the problem either by your set of tools or by your tradition or by your outlook or by that kind of thing. So let's give an example in programming. It's not a very complex concept to put a web page up and have a type-in box.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of accidental complexity around it because of the way we approach it. Mm. You've got to have ASP.NET, you've got to have SQL Server, you've got to have JavaScript, you've got to have HTML, you have CSS, XML, and let's keep going, XSD, XSLT. And this is so you can put your name in a box and click OK. Mm. Never mind the security things. Those were solved a while ago, but I mean, back in the wild and woolly days of the internet, was it going to be TLS? Was it going to be HTTPS? Was it going to be some of these message-based protocols like SET? Mm. There's so many options, and I call this accidental complexity because it's not inherent in the problem. You could imagine, if you were indulging in wishful thinking, that there would be a lot easier ways to do it. We're kind of stuck with the complexities for now. I think one of the horizons that's coming in the next decade or so is there will be consolidation that will reduce this kind of complexity.
Interesting.
For example, the declarative programming movements, you know, the pure functional programming and things like this. These are approaches to, and Haskell is sort of the beacon. It sort of leads the way there, right?
Sure.
It's very pure. They're trying to reduce the accidental complexity in programming itself. Mm. And I'm not saying that the world will consolidate around any particular thing, but I think there will be a consolidation as people get sick and tired of having all of these, you know, bodging together all of these different pieces that were designed separately and had a different kind of design desiderata or design criteria around
sure.
them. And then they get bodged together. Did the guys who create XML know that it was going to have to interface with SQL Server? Well, it doesn't really smell like a SQL Server interface mm-hmm. sort of thing, but you do need to do that with it, don't you?
Sure.
So you got to put XML in your SQL Server, and you got to put SQL Server in your XML, and the things, you know, it's kind of messy to put them together because mm-hmm. they weren't designed together. So I think that's in the long run there's going to be consolidation in this area, and I spend a lot of time worrying about this.
Certainly. And that's why I sort of asked the question initially. One of the key things that you do, and this goes back to your days in VB.
Absolutely,
You want to take the complexity out of simplicity. right?
Right. That's right.
What we call simplicity.
That's right.
The higher order language where it's really easy to object orientation and,
yeah.
You know.
We're very good at what we, the situation we're in now is complex things are possible to do mm-hmm. and simple things are hard to do.
Yes.
And we want to get to the state where simple things are easy to do once again. Mm-hmm. And I think the principle, the overarching principle has got to be composability, radical composability.
Radical composability.
Radical composability, meaning when you write a software artifact, you should be able to reuse it in another context. That means it's composable. Mm. That means its dependencies on the context have to be controllable in some sort of reasonable way.
Okay.
Let me give you an example of something that is perhaps an extreme of non-composability. Let's say you're a hardware vendor and you create a device driver. You've got to create one for Windows, maybe different ones for different versions of Windows. You've got to create one for the Macintosh. You've got to create one for Linux. There's no composability of that essential driver component. The driver component is going to be doing the same thing. Let's say it's a sound card. You're going to be taking some signals in and putting them into the sound card. But all of this ceremonial interfacing that you have to do with the particular operating system is completely different from one to the other. And that's the bulk of your work
sure.
in maintaining that. And chances are, the bugs that are in your device driver, oh, well, you wouldn't create a device driver that has
not.
Bugs.
No way.
But somebody else
yeah,
would have bugs in a device driver.
A lesser
human might sure. have some bugs. Probably not going to be in the part of the component that does the essential work of translating input signals into sounds coming out the speaker.
Sure.
It's probably going to be in this complex ceremonial interface that you have to do with the rest of it. That's where your mess is.
Okay.
Make sure that you lock when you're going to set these four fields
yep.
And then done. And make sure that you allocate some memory over here and free it over there. And don't free it over there if you freed it over here. And make sure that you interlock the freeing of the memory with other device drivers because, you know.
Yes.
Not fun. Not
no.
fun. Is that accidental complexity or is it essential complexity? The device driver case is an interesting one because you could argue that either way. You could say, well, it's essential because the operating system being very close to the hardware is exposing only it's exposing the least amount of complexity that you can get away with and write a device driver.
Hmm.
Is that really true? Or Has there been research that's tried to modularize device drivers?
I don't know. I mean,
maybe even make them dynamically loadable so that you don't have to link them into the operating system.
That would be amazing.
It would be amazing because then maybe you wouldn't blue screen if there were a bug, not in your device
driver. Of course not, because of course mine are always in user mode anyway.
Yeah,
I won't write kernel mode device drivers.
Well, no. You can't do that, right?
No.
Because then you can crash the kernel.
Yes.
Well, that's not fun.
You don't want to do that.
All right.
Interesting. But let me ask you a question. You and Eric talk a lot about functional programming.
Yes.
And then at the same time, you talk about the importance of side effects.
Yes.
Now, the side effects inherent in a device driver are clear. It is not side effect free. That's
no.
the whole idea.
That's the whole
you're
idea.
You're going to produce a sound. You're going to take in some voice and record it, whatever.
Right, right.
But so let's talk about, why aren't device drivers written in pure functional languages?
Well, that's a great question. Of course, in some sense, conceptually, they are. The computer itself is a monad.
Whoa. All right.
The state of the computer okay. is encapsulated in an abstract object. That's the virtual address space or even the physical address
wow.
space if you're programming at that level. And every time the computer, every time your device driver steps an instruction, it modifies the state and passes it on to the next functional unit, which is the next instruction. So at a conceptual level, it's monadic. There are laws of nature at play here.
Mm.
But the programming language and the programming technology doesn't take that monadic structure, elevate it to the surface, and then discipline it with static types.
Hmm.
See, that's what we do with the functional programming languages like Haskell, where you've got static types to help you with monadic composition. Remember our little state monad
yes,
video where
absolutely.
You've got one in and two out, and it's kind of strange. How did you get two out from one in? Well, there's a closure on this kind of thing, and the type system checks it all
okay.
for you, and that threads the state through all of the state transitions. It's no different from assembly language instructions modifying the, or it's no different from a Turing machine, writing values to the tape.
Mm.
no different conceptually. It's just that the programming language and technology helps you control it. So there we go. This is now we're closing full circle.
Okay.
So at one extreme, we have device drivers with all of this complex ceremony that they have to do to run. And then at the other extreme, you have something like Haskell, which is dead simple from one point of view. If you have a piece of code, there are only two ways to get information into it. It either comes in as a function, as an input parameter, as an argument that gets bound to an input parameter, or it comes in as a free variable. So if you have a function that f of x equals x plus y, x is a bound variable and y is a free variable. Those are the only ways to get information into a function. You have only two things to look at. You don't have to worry about this bank of memory over here and maybe this segment is aliasing these two separate banks of memory. You have to worry about the locks on them, you know, and all of this kind of thing.
Sure.
Just reduce it down to two. So we have two complete extremes. We have, on the one hand, writing at the machine level, you have all kinds of opportunities for implicit dependence of your device driver on every single detail of the machine.
Yeah.
And on the other extreme, in Haskell programming, you have only two ways to get information in. Mm-hmm. So your life is a lot easier, because if something goes wrong, you have only two things to look at.
Interesting. So, I mean, let's talk about why aren't operating systems written in...
Well, there is an effort to write an operating system in Haskell. The name has escaped me at the moment, but there's an entire operating system written in Haskell.
Is it general purpose?
Yeah. Put me on the spot here, yeah.
Probably not.
Go to Haskell.org and look
find
it up.
Out.
But yeah, no, there are definitely people who are thinking about these kind of things and doing hard work. There's nothing in principle to prevent it. Mm-hmm. What you have to do is change the way that you look at problems, because a traditional way of writing an operating system is very well understood. There are not very many people who can do it well. But the people who do it extremely well, and some of them are here at Microsoft, and some of them are out in the jungle out there, you know, other companies.
Absolutely.
But writing operating systems and device drivers in pure functional languages is new territory.
Okay.
And you have the hazard with functional programming is that since things are immutable, it's all too easy to make copies of data. Mm. The easiest way to write a function is, well, make a copy of if you've got something that you need to change, mm-hmm. make a copy of it where everything else is the same except one thing. This can get expensive fast. Say you have a tree. Everybody who's got experience with functional programming has been bitten by trees.
Mm. Bitten by trees?
Bitten by trees.
Nice.
Nice picture.
Only
right
functional
there.
Programmers can be bitten by trees.
They can be bitten by trees.
All right.
Because you can't update a cell in a tree. What you can do, the easiest program, if you just write it out, you know, functional programming lets you write your program as if it were mathematical equations. If you just write it out as a bunch of equations, you say, well, I want everything to be the same in this tree, except I want to add one leaf to it. Well, you can't add a leaf to a tree. What you can do is copy the entire tree, make a copy of the tree with the new leaf added. Oh, this hurts. Mm-hmm. So now you have a whole new branch of science, if you will, of just how to share structure. Because actually, the only part of the tree that you actually want to modify is this one where you're hooking in the new leaf. The rest of the tree can and should be shared. So how do you write a functional program that does that, when all you have at your disposal in functional programming is functions, in pure functional programming?
Okay.
Of course, in something like F#, you have side effects. So you just poke the thing into the tree and you're done. And it's cheap and it's fast and it's almost as good as writing it in machine language.
Excellent.
But it's not pure, because you've done a side effect and some other component on another thread that's looking at your part of the tree, oops, surprise, it changed.
Sure.
So that's the hazard. That's the hazard. The advantage of functional programming is it's completely safe. You define a variable, and as long as that variable is alive, it points to the same thing. If you write it, because it's equations,
mm-hmm.
you say x equals 5, that's an equation.
Sure.
You don't get to say x equals 3. You already said x equals 5.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say x equals some big tree and some other thread is looking at x, your contract with that thread is that x equals, it's an equation, mm-hmm. equals the tree. You can't change it.
Understood.
But you need to add some information to the tree. So you make a new x, x2, that's the same as the old tree except it's got this thing added. And how do you do that efficiently? That's a real trick.
Now, I thought that was sort of one of the benefits of a monad, Like, right? The IO monad in Haskell allows you to actually do something useful.
Yes.
And have a side effect.
It does, and you can't have a side effect because the thing that you're passing in, the IO that you're passing in, mm-hmm. is not the same as the IO that you're passing out. And you chain them together with the bind operator so that the dependencies are explicit. You say, I can't do put care until I've done get care because they're bound by this bind operator. Mm-hmm. So you don't actually sequence the operations by saying sequence. Instead, what you do is you explicitly denote the functional dependencies.
Okay.
And so the computation proceeds by, it's sort of intelligent recalc, right? Mm. It's very similar to Excel intelligent recalc. Excel knows when you change some little cell over here that it doesn't have to calculate absolutely everything in the
But Excel
in the
is
sheet.
A functional programming language.
It is. It's declarative. It's pure declarative because it all it does is track dependencies.
Okay.
So the value in cell over here depends on the values of cells over there. Change one of them, you got to redo this computation. But parts of the computation didn't change. You don't have to do anything.
Okay, so now
they're in the monad. The worksheet is the state monad.
The worksheet is the state monad.
Right.
Okay.
That's the ambient monad that your entire Excel program is working in.
Ambient monad. I wanted to define that once and for all.
Okay, good.
Ambient monad means the monad in which you're working in,
right.
Whether you realize it or not. It's just there.
It's there, right.
Okay.
And the computer memory is the ambient monad. So although the individual pieces of your side-affecting program are not monadic, the entire computation is monadic because it just has to be.
Okay.
That's the point.
All right.
That's the point.
Now let's move way out into outer space.
Okay,
literally.
Good. Yeah.
And so you're an astrophysicist.
That's true.
You're an OS composer. You wrote Time Warp with your colleagues.
Time Warp operating system,
programming languages, and some things that we still can't talk about, Niners. I'm sorry. You will hear about it.
We will,
Let's talk a little bit about your relationship in your mind between black holes and physics and all these really incredible things in the universe and the stuff you work on every day as a language guy or a software engineer.
Well, I guess the easiest way to explain it is how I got into it. In order to complete my PhD, I had to write a lot of code. My PhD thesis was on photometry. It was on the dark matter problem.
Nice.
And one of the ways that we approach the dark matter problem is we find out how much light matter there is. And then we, by other means, we know how much matter there is, usually dynamical means. You measure the rotation speeds of things. Mm. And you say, gosh, there's a whole lot more matter here than I can account for by the light matter. So what I did was a measurement of the light matter in the Coma cluster of galaxies. And what I got was this thing called a photomicrodensitometer.
Okay.
And this is a guy that, this is a gadget that scans photographs and turns, this was way back in the dark ages. It was a big deal back then, right? But it
actually physical pictures.
Yeah.
No, data.
Glass plates. This was before CCDs. CCDs were just being invented.
All right.
And we actually had to cook them in hydrogen, hot hydrogen, very dangerous, every now and then one of these ovens would blow up and hurt somebody. But to kind of precondition the photographic emulsion, and then we would go up in the telescope and sit there all night staring at a guide star and wiggling the telescope around so that we could get a nice deep picture of the galaxies. Hmm. So I did that. And then the next step is to digitize the plate. So this photomicrodensitometer was literally on a big hunk of granite bolted to the bedrock, because every time a truck would go by, it would shake and it would get a little bit of off kilter, right? Mm-hmm. And this lens would scan back and forth like this. And would write a tape.
Okay.
And the tape would contain the data. Well, the first thing you had to do was tell this machine how fast to move. And what you wanted was the lens, by the time it started, by the time it hit the edge of the plate, you want to have constant velocity.
Okay.
So you got to do this kind of ramp up. So you have to do a physics simulation in the device driver for the microdensitometer to spin it up so that you know that it accelerates up to the speed, run it across the thing, and then decelerate it at the other end. So you imagine, this is a big, heavy camera that's scanning back and forth across this thing.
All right.
So you got to have little tables for, So you actually have to do mechanics simulation in the device driver, and that was fun. But there wasn't any interface between this machine and the rest of the world. The machine was being run by a PerkinElmer Interdata I-32, one of the world's first 32-bit computers, by the way.
Wow.
Because PDP-11s and PDP-10s were 16-bit computers.
Okay.
This guy, we would get literally patch tapes from the company. This would be a piece of paper that said, take some glue and put a little, cover up one of the holes on the paper tape that contains the code for the operating system. So that's why they call it patching.
Wow.
Because you literally patch the paper tape.
Now, wait a minute. Yeah. Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. The operating system was in a spool of paper tape about this big, and you'd mount it on the paper tape reader, and it would load it into the...
Wow.
And then the physics simulator for spinning up the photomicrodensitometer was in that too.
Okay.
And when they corrected bugs in it, they would send you a paper, say, you know, go to position 1653 and cover up the third hole from the left with the little glue paper.
Amazing.
Like this, yeah.
That is the advent of patching.
The history of patching.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And I'm sure it goes back, you know, I'm a youngster compared
sure.
to the...
Sure. But that's still pretty explicit and like...
Very, very
that's
explicit.
That's an analog definition of... So...
But you've seen
an analog experience.
It's absolutely an analog experience, but it's analog to digital.
Sure.
So you've seen me show these APOD pictures.
Yes.
And I love these clusters of galaxies because that's my youth. You know, that's what I did for my that's what I did in my youth was measure the light in clusters of galaxies, and I had a tremendous amount of fun doing that. 2,350 galaxies in the Coma Cluster when I did my doctorate.
Wow.
And I measured the light output of all of those things, and of course we found out that it's way less than the amount of matter that you can account for by the spinning, by the rotational speed which you get from the redshifts. The thing is spinning much, much faster than you can account for by the amount of light that you
so
make.
So therefore it has to be dark matter.
We can't see it. We know it's there because of the spin rate.
Okay.
Things are orbiting. There's a lot of mass in there.
What if we're in one big ambient black hole?
You know, there's this is not an insane idea.
Okay.
I was just having a debate with a friend of mine who thinks that there are turtles all the way down. Hmm. He thinks that inside every particle is another universe, and inside every universe,
fractal. Yeah, you know, I
don't think so. And
okay.
I think a couple of reasons I don't think so. One of them is, there doesn't, as far as anyone can tell, there's no internal structure to leptons and quarks, which means they bottom out. You slam them into each other as hard as you can, and there's nothing interesting to look at. There are no springs and bolts inside.
Okay.
They just seem to be points.
Hmm.
And another thing that bottoms out is black holes. That once things, except for Hawking radiation, which can cause them to evaporate, once stuff falls into a black hole, it's gone, and you can't stop it from falling in, and all the information about it is wiped out, except the electric charge, the angular momentum, and the mass. That's it. Everything else is wiped out. Any sort of quantum numbers, how many strange particles, charmed particles, and it's just gone. So there are these bottoms in the universe. Now, my friend who argues turtles all the way down, he doesn't believe in black holes.
Uh-huh.
He thinks our mathematics is completely broken. Our mathematics predicts black holes. You just can't, if you put enough mass in one place, everything goes in and nothing comes out because the speed of light is constant.
Unless that's wrong.
Well, there are other ways in which you can avoid black holes. Actually, one of the little secrets is that from outside the black hole, you will actually never observe anything falling in. Because as you get closer and closer to the black hole, time slows down and slows down and slows down, and eventually slows down infinitely. So this is why the vicinity of black holes are spewing massive amounts of radiation. Because what you're watching is the buildup of all this stuff. Now, from its point of view, it falls in. It goes, and it's gone.
Okay.
But from our point of view, it's bunching up. And bunching up, and bunching up, and bunching up, and bunching up, and it never goes in. And so it's all this bunching up that's doing, there's, you know, it's forming inciting nuclear reactions, and, you know, you get gamma ray bursts and all other kinds of just nasty, nasty, powerful stuff happening.
Absolutely. Now, so let's bring this back.
Okay.
To programming.
Yes.
And go back to the notion of simplifying complexity. So,
okay.
For example, E equals MC squared
right.
is the canonical simplification of incredibly complex concepts.
Yes.
Speed of light,
right.
matter, you know, mass, whatever.
Right.
Isolating that, and I've seen the math that actually gets there.
Yes.
It's pretty complicated.
Yeah, it's pretty complicated.
Okay.
Right, right.
So let's.
The ideas are even more complicated.
The ideas are even more complicated.
Right.
So we have similar problems in the programming world.
You have tons of problems like this.
Okay.
Yeah. Where it's the accidental complexity versus the
yes.
essential complexity once again.
So where's
E equals MC squared gets rid of all the accidental complexity. It says, guess what? I went through all of this seemingly complicated
ceremony.
Stuff, all of this elaborate ceremony, and I found out that there is an equation that always obtains.
Interesting.
If there's any mass around and any energy around, they're related by this equation. And I can convert back and forth from one to the other. Now, how exactly the machinery that causes this conversion, that's where the complexity arises in a particular situation. Is it spherically symmetric? Is it toroidal? You know, whatever. You get all the complexity you want from solving particular problems.
Okay.
But the equation obtains. And we're looking for the same kind of thing in computing. And I think the answer is radical composability.
Okay.
But again, you know, there is a spectrum of... there is a spectrum of complexity. On the one hand, where we're, you know, writing device drivers close to machine, we have all the complexity you want and more.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, with something as radically pure as Haskell,
mm-hmm.
you have only two ways to get information in. So it's really hard to be non-composable when you have only two ways to hook things together.
Certainly.
You want to hook it. You write some complex function and you want to hook it into something else. There are only two ways. You got only two things you got to look at. It's not so bad. And then there's the gray area in between, where you have general purpose technologies like C# and F#, where they want to serve both camps. You can write pure code in pure functional code in C# or F#, just don't do any side effects. Thank
okay.
you. Or you can write code that's closer to the middle, and you can side effect all over the place. So you have, in some sense, you have the best of both worlds. And if you're working with tools like that, then the amount of complexity that you take on as an intelligent software engineer, you make a decision. Say, I'm going to give up on some composability and reusability, because the whole point of composability is reusability.
Okay.
I'm going to give up on some composability in order to get performance. You know what? I'm not going to copy my tree just because I need to change one leaf. I'm going to poke it, and I'm going to make sure that in the rest of my code, no other thread is referring to this tree in a surprising way. There aren't going to be any surprises. This means that in order to write this module, you have to consider the entire program. You can't just write it as a modular piece that modifies trees.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be fitted into a program that isn't going to violate the contract and peek at the tree.
Sure.
And expect it to be not modified and find out that it's modified.
Now, why isn't the why isn't the program an ambient monad?
Well, it is. It is in a way, but the parts of the program have to cooperate.
Okay.
There's an implicit contract that says, you know what, this pointer, this reference is pointing to a block of memory, and I'm over here on thread A, and I get to change that block of memory whenever I want to. And you over there on thread B, you have an implicit contract that says you don't expect this thing to be constant, because thread A over here is changing it willy-nilly.
Okay.
So that's an implicit contract. It's different from an explicit contract. Somebody looking just at the code for thread B, not knowing that it's in an ambient monad with thread A, doesn't know about this contract. So this piece of code is not reusable without this extra knowledge that's written down in a document or written down in a comment, and we all know how well comments are maintained.
Sure, absolutely.
So this is where the complexity comes in, and this is where the engineering cost comes in.
Okay.
It's expensive to maintain programs like this because of the implicit implicit contracts. Over here in the extreme pure world, which has its performance problems, there are no implicit contracts. Only two ways to get data into a function. You are looking at the function and you know everything you need to know to interface that function with the outside world. It's either an input parameter or it's a free variable. And you can tell the free variables just textually, just looking at it. If there's a variable in your code and it isn't a parameter, it's a free variable.
Okay.
Period. You're done. You don't have to do any work. You don't have to go call somebody, hey, are there any hazards if I use this tree inspector?
Mm-hmm.
this tree visiting pattern, and you know, oh, don't use that because there's a thread over here that's listening to the internet and modifying the tree on the fly. You can't use it. You can't look at that. You can't do the visitor on that tree without first locking it down or whatever.
Okay, so listen, I've been watching the Monty Python documentary, and I'm sure lots of people love Monty Python.
He's not dead. He's just sleeping.
Exactly. So, what's the holy grail of this, what you're talking about? What is the holy grail of compositionality in programming? I mean, DLLs are modules.
They are the idea,
they created them to modularize Windows and other, you know.
Sure.
That didn't work out too well. Or does it work out well?
Well, it works out in a way, but there's still implicit knowledge. You still have to have a DLL has a list of all the symbols that it exports and all the symbols that it imports, so you know how it hooks up with everything, but you don't know operationally which operations are safe in there and which operations are not. Thread safe, for example.
Okay.
Because of side effecting. These things can have side effects, and something else can look at your data, and it all falls apart. But it's partly composable. Hey, you've got some information there, right? Mm-hmm. You've got your list of imports, list of exports. When you run the thing, you get a deadlock. Oops.
Fair enough.
The Holy Grail.
Yes.
Now, all right, so I'm going to do something that I never do.
Okay.
Except with you.
All right.
And that's indulge in wishful thinking.
Great.
The wishful thinking is that we would have the functional simplicity, the contractual simplicity of pure functional programming, only two ways to hook things up, and the performance of side-effecting programming. Hmm. Now, I know that it's not possible in all, you know, in all generality.
Okay.
And I also know that some of these performant tree manipulation programs are incredibly complex. But they're complex in the essential way, not in the accidental way. Because if you try to write a pure functional tree manipulation program that also shares data when it can be shared and things like that, the mathematics that you're writing down now starts to get elaborate.
Okay.
So I guess I'm sneaking the word elaborate in there as distinct from the word complex.
Okay.
Complexity in my mind has these two parts. Elaborate seems to me is a word I like to use for the essential complexity of things.
The essential complexity.
Right. So, for example, if we write down the mathematics for a spinning charged black hole, it's going to be a lot of paper, a lot of white. Well, we went through the chain rule.
Yes, we did.
And that's simple. The essential complexity of that is quite small.
Okay.
And yet it's a lot of ink on the whiteboard. The concept is easy, but the amount of stuff that you got to write down is elaborate.
Okay.
It's elaborate.
It's essential.
It's essential.
To get to the end point.
Right. I don't think there's a shorter way to write it.
Okay.
You know, and one of the things I did when I was presenting this was critique the ancient, derivative notation, df, dx, and all that. The downside of that notation is, again, just like these programs that hide their implicit contracts, there's a lot of implicit information in a notation like that. The notation doesn't work. It actually transforms essential complexity into accidental complexity. Because you have to know that when you write df dx, what you're really talking about is a linear approximation to another function, which other function? F. And oh, by the way, you have to supply a value of the point at which you are going to compute this linear approximation. The other notation that takes a lot of ink but is completely explicit, you can't escape that the fact that you're looking at a linear transformation of a linear approximation of another function at a certain point is explicit. So the issues are between explicit and implicit. Sometimes implicit knowledge helps because it makes things short, small, and compact, less elaborate. But sometimes it hurts. And by the way, the analogy in the computing world is with implicit information, you can have more performance. It also increases the accidental complexity because these implicit contracts are the oops, oh, by the ways. You know, these are like when you buy a car and then you've signed all the check and then it's, oh, by the way.
Yeah,
you don't like those. We don't like the oh, by the ways.
Did you wanted to start the car, didn't you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Or be able to stop it after it goes 50.
Yeah, did you want Windows in that?
Yeah.
That'll be just a little bit extra, yeah.
Excellent. So let me try to, you know, explain what I think I heard.
Okay.
And ask another question. So if the Holy Grail is creating this hybrid programming world where you have the power and beauty and predictability of pure functional.
The composability
right. And pure functional. And then you, at the same time, have the expressibility and sort of performance and the ease with which to compose complex systems in imperative type languages. And there's a
right.
reason why people love them.
Oh, yeah.
What about if we just change the way we program in the already existing languages? You can write functionally in C++.
I can.
Right?
I absolutely can.
So let's talk about if you learn to think and act functionally and compose functionally, you know, maybe it doesn't require a brand new language.
You don't always have to program functionally. Sometimes it doesn't help. When you need the ultimate in performance or efficiency, you want to use all the implicit contracts. But if in the other parts of your program where you need composability and reusability, if you stick to a pure functional discipline, you'll be better off. You'll be able to reuse those components. So composability and pure functional programming and all these kind of things, they're about reuse. And software reuse has been a holy grail for a long time.
Okay.
They've been beating that drum for decades. We've spent all this time and money creating this software, and we want to be able to reuse it. But it costs almost as much to integrate the old software into the new context as it does to just create it from scratch again. And that's the dilemma people face with software reuse. Mm. The implicit dependencies of some software component on its context make it so hard to integrate that it's just easier to write it from scratch. It's cheaper.
Mm.
It's cheaper. Easier usually means cheaper because programmers cost money. And
yes,
then the essential economics, the entire debate, which often turns into a heated religious debate about whether I should program this way or program that way, it really does boil down to a basic economic decision. What costs more in an application, the computer's time or the programmer's time? If the computer's time, this is this economic choice is very clear in high-performance computing. It's no question about it. We'll spend absolutely any amount of human time that we need to get computer efficiency because our problems are so hard, we need every cycle of the CPU to be devoted. That's called efficiency.
Mm.
Performance, on the other hand, means it just has to be fast enough. You get a quarter of a second when clicking on a button to see the web page. You can do an awful lot of computation, and now you can afford the luxury of having some composability and reuse because the economics there is it's actually more costly to reproduce the software than to write it in a composable way and pay some computer efficiency cost.
Mm.
What you get back is the human efficiency cost. I don't have to write this code again.
Yes.
And the BCL has been a great victory in this. There's a whole bunch of stuff we used to have to write every time you start a new application. You write a list library, you write a tree library, you write all this junk. Because hacking it out of your old application and putting it in the new application was just more costly than writing it again from scratch.
Hmm.
So now we got .NET and the BCL, and we don't normally write new list libraries and new tree libraries and new enumerables. So we already have a lot of software reuse.
Excellent.
And it's getting better.
It is.
Yeah.
Now, ambient simplicity
very good.
And ambient complexity, as a developer, essentially what I'm hearing, and this is a beautiful picture when you think about it, there's the ambient simplicity monad, which isn't really a monad, but when I compose, I want my composition to be the only thing I'm concentrating on. Imagine being a musician.
Yes.
And when you're writing your score or you're writing this beautiful piece of music, you spend 3/4 of your time having to like fiddle with the line positioning and the paper and all that stuff.
Right.
That should be ambient complexity or complexity that's not in your face.
Right.
But you have the simplicity right in your face.
Yes.
So the compositionality that you're talking about also up front, it's nice to write in a beautiful language, in a simple, expressive, beautiful language.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up music. The ultimate in composable music is the blues. Yeah, right?
Okay.
Because I'm a band leader. I can just go like I can go like this and say that means a blues in G because it's one sharp. Or I can go 4 flats. You know, I can call a blues just like that. And if we're good musicians, then we know exactly that we can compose it on the fly because it's modular music.
Perfect.
And we don't have to deal with all of this inessential ceremonial complexity of writing it down.
Mm-hmm. Right on. On that note, thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Charles.
We'll continue this conversation.
Good.